Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Hello and welcome to the Autosport Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas. Welcome to our first podcast of 2021, where we're going to be discussing some of the big Formula One news stories that have broken this week. First up is the news broken by Motorsport.com's F1 editor Jonathan Noble that Suzuki MotoGP team boss Davide Brivio is leaving the team to head up the rebranded Alpine F1 squad. And John is one of my guests on today's show, and the other is Autosport's F1 reporter Luke Smith. But John, let's start with the Brivio news, and what does that mean now for the former Renault team?
I think it's quite a smart move, actually. We first got wind of it kind of 2 days ago. It's one of these classic F1 stories. There's a little bit of a rumour, and you try and piece things together, and at no point are you ever given 100% yes, because people are ducking behind either no comments or there's misinformation. But we slowly pieced it together, and we think, because it's not been officially announced yet by Alpine, he's joining the team as CEO and will work alongside Marcin Budkowski, who will be the new team principal, with Cyril Abiteboul moving on to a more senior role at Alpine. He's been working on the new project. And when it's first announced, you think, well, why would a Formula One team bring across someone from MotoGP? Because they seem, although they're both top level, you know, motorsport categories, they're very different beasts in terms of the size of operations and what you need to be successful and where the challenges and the costs are. But the more you kind of dig into it, and I've been speaking to Lewis Duncan, our MotoGP correspondent, it's actually really, really smart. So Brivio kind of created and headed up and brought along the Suzuki MotoGP team, not the biggest team, so it's a team that had to operate to a limited budget, but got the structure there. He brought on young riders, got them winning, I think, within their second season. So 20, they came back into 15. He won the first race win was 16. And last season won the championship. So a phenomenal performance. And I think he's perfect for, as F1 goes to a cost cap era, you know, sorting the resources out, operating efficiencies, bringing on staff, motivating staff, all those sort of bigger picture elements that I think do transpose across from MotoGP, rather than being the kind of the team principal sat on the pit wall, because Budkowski is perfect for that.
Absolutely. Well, we'll come back maybe to how it will work in terms of, you know, a CEO at Formula One team, how that will work with the team principal and the actual, you know, sort of managing a squad from that point of view. But Luke, why is this such a good move for Alpine? You know, I think Renault have copped a fair bit of criticism since they came back, or it came back as a works team in 2016, for promising a lot,
underachieving. Okay, yeah, it had a significantly smaller budget compared to the bigger squads, but then, you know, maybe it should have been a bit more realistic with its aims if that's what it was going to do when it came racing. But this, on paper, from everything I've read and learned in the last few days, because I'll admit it, I'm not massively clued up on MotoGP, although I did used to love it back in the day. But then when it moved to BT Sport, and it wasn't immediately in front of me on the BBC, just managed to slip it through. But that was probably my error. Obviously, an excellent championship with some excellent racing and some excellent talents involved. But yeah, why is this such a good move, we think, on paper for Alpine?
I think it does just tick every single box that Alpine is missing right now, really. And the Renault has been missing. And I think that Brivio comes in, he's got a track record of punching well above his weight and sort of working with limited resources, as John said. I mean, up against the likes of Honda, Yamaha, who obviously have been so dominant in MotoGP for so long. And yet he was able to take little Suzuki basically all the way to the top, which was a brilliant, brilliant success. He's got experience as well in terms of marrying sort of two separate teams together, with the Suzuki operational team coming from Italy, and then with the actual sort of the base back in Japan as well for the manufacturer, which for Renault is important as they sort of marry up the Enstone base in the UK and what they've got in Viry with the engine side of things. So it's that kind of thing that's very, very good. He's got an excellent track record for bringing young talent through to MotoGP as well. He's always sort of been a big believer in getting youth and fresh blood in. And Renault, their sort of academy has been a big focus for them over the years. And they've still not achieved their goal of getting a young driver into Formula One as a Renault Works driver. They've got Guan Yu Zhou and Christian Lundgaard, probably the two most prominent juniors on their books right now. So it's going to be interesting to see what he does with them. But I think it's more experience, and it's interesting to see so many of these teams have gone down the route of having sort of more than just one top figure in charge of the team. So we've seen it at McLaren. They've got team principal Andrea Seidel, then Zep Brown as a CEO role. Williams have gone down a similar route now as well, with Jos Capito coming in over the winter as CEO to work with Simon Roberts, team principal. Ferrari, you can see between Mattia Binotto and Laurent Mekies, they're two very, very experienced guys. And it's that kind of model, I think, that is something more and more teams are looking towards. And I think for Renault, well, Alpine as it's going to be, I think it's really important to get that kind of experience in from a guy who knows how to do a lot with not very much. And I think it's a really good step for them, because, yeah, they haven't performed as well as I think we'd all expected. I think a few years ago, the top manufacturers were sort of looking at Renault and thinking they're sort of shaping up for the new regulations and for everything coming in the future, a bit similar to how Mercedes was for 2014, and really make that step. And getting Daniel Ricciardo was obviously a huge coup. But they got a couple of podiums in 2020, but it's not really hit the heights that it was anticipated to. So I think this is, yeah, a really canny hire. I think it's a very, very good step in the right direction. And I think that Brivio comes in knowing how to do everything that Renault are looking for with Alpine, just in a very different formula. And I think it's going to be really interesting if his experience on two wheels can transfer over to four quite nicely.
And John, what will Brivio be doing as expected CEO at Alpine that, as we say, expected team principal as well, Marcin Petkowski, wouldn't be doing in that role? How do the two work together? As Luke said, there's lots of examples now of it in Formula One, but what does it actually break down as?
I would guess, because obviously we haven't yet had official confirmation and we haven't spoken to the people involved, so what they may be planning may be different from what we can say at the moment. But I would suspect that Budkowski takes more control of the kind of the day-to-day operations. So you're looking at the next races, running the race team on the race weekend, dealing with the drivers on a day-to-day basis, all that sort of thing. And then Davide will have more kind of bigger picture stuff, so he can be looking at long-term planning and strategic planning for the long term and maximizing resources and increasing efficiencies and targeting where the focus of spending should go. So kind of similar to what we see maybe at McLaren with Zak Brown and Andreas Seidel. Andreas is very much day-to-day, running things on the ground, dealing with the drivers, dealing with running the team, keeping tabs on every single track session. And Zach's much bigger picture, like kind of investment and money and sponsors and strategy and board management. So I suspect it will be along those lines.
And what do we think this will mean for current Renault Alpine team boss Cyril Abitbol? John, you mentioned that he might be moving somewhere more sort of senior in the Alpine brand company. Why would that make sense for him? Why is that something that he might want to do? Is it all part of a grand plan, as it were?
Yeah, well, when Luca De Meo, the Renault CEO, came in July last year, he started, and just looking at kind of where the Renault car company would go. Obviously, all car companies have taken a bit of a battering in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. But his first task was to debate about whether Renault stayed in Formula One. That was a big box tick. He felt that the cost cap and the new financial models suited Renault, so they could go forwards. And when he looked at the car company, he felt that it was best to, you know, have some key brands that they push forward, and just to better give some better lines of attack for them. So his decision was that Alpine, you know, should be resurrected as a brand, as a sports car manufacturer, as a the motorsport kind of representation of the Renault Group. And his decision was to put Cyril in charge of a strategic plan. So, you know, Cyril's recommendation of the team name, Cyril's recommendation of, you know, where they're going to go with their other motorsport activities. And, I mean, from day one, once we found out that Cyril had been put in charge, he was asked about his future as team principal. And all the time he was saying that, you know, I am committed until the end of this year. That I, you know, what the strategic strategy is beyond that is not for me to say, but I'm committed to the end of this year. So the clues were there, I think, from the beginning. And it will be a, you know, a step up for Cyril. He'll be in charge of, potentially in charge of the whole Alpine company, involvement in motorsport programs. So, you know, probably a good time to hand over to a joint attack of Marchin and Brivio.
Indeed. Well, I read Lewis Duncan did a feature about Davide Brivio and explaining exactly what Alpine will be getting from the current Suzuki the announcement has been made. He has left Suzuki MotoGP team boss. And there was a quote in there, a very glowing quote from Valentino Rossi, who, of course, the two of them worked together at Yamaha back at the middle of the 2000s, very successfully, of course. And, you know, we can take Rossi as a motorsport legend, but Alpine have actually got one on their books as well. It's Fernando Alonso. Luke, famously demanding, famously outspoken. Do you think he will welcome this news?
I thought it was quite interesting when Ricciardo left that the way that Renault, when they made the announcement, didn't really make any, they didn't thank him or anything. It was a bit of a pop shot from Cyril when we had that. And I think we've seen on Drive to Survive a couple of times, I think Cyril has maybe been a few question marks about sort of like, what is he doing with Renault? Like, how far are things going? And I think that when Alonso got announced, he's got a track record for the team bosses, often him outlasting them. And he was asked about it a few years ago, and he was rattled off all these lists of names. Eric Boullier, I think it was just after Eric Boullier left McLaren. And Alonso went, oh, well, they were all getting very old, you know. And it was obviously just such a cop-out answer and a really, really cheeky one. So he has got a bit of a track record for that. But I think it's quite interesting that Alonso's coming back as sort of this, clearly it's different this time around, you would imagine. He's much older. It's probably going to be his final F1 deal. And Brivio coming in as the new guy, it's not like Alonso is coming in to change the team, to change Renault, to sort of usher in the new Alpine era. It's very much a wholesale change all around, where you've got Brivio, you've got Bukowski coming in as well in that role. So I think it is, yeah, things are changing. I think Alonso's just got to deal with it, basically. I think that this is not a case of him coming in and saying, look, I want the team run like this, or trying to be overly demanding or anything like that. I think that Renault, the fact that it's going to be all changed for this year coming, I think that's really exciting. And I think it maybe will sort of maybe put a bit of a cap on Alonso in terms of how pushy he can be. Because, he can't sort of point at the previous couple of years for Renault and say, well, you've not been performing well before, I want changes, because those changes are happening for this season.
Indeed, and there are also changes at another squad announced this week. It's Williams, which is the next big F1 news story we're going to discuss. And the announcement on Tuesday that it has expanded its technical collaboration with Mercedes to include the supply of certain transferable components from 2022. Now, skipping past the rather amusing gags that this might include George Russell from next season, which I thought was very witty from the various people that put that out on Twitter. What this ultimately means is that the team's new owners have made a pretty significant decision to change the ethos of the squad in terms of doing it all by itself, really. But Luke, what exactly will Williams be getting from Mercedes from the start of next year?
So it is gearbox related, is the centre of it. So gearboxes and the sort of related hydraulic parts, which is obviously such an important thing. And it's sort of always been a bit strange that they've run Mercedes power units since 2014, but they've never taken the gearbox as well, which is obviously so integral to how they the engine and power unit works. So it's a big step, definitely. And I think it's something that Lawrence Stroll, when he was when Lance was racing for the team, he was quite keen to see that kind of partnership be furthered. But Williams were always under the when the family was in charge, was so defiant, saying, no, we want to retain our independence, do everything ourselves. And I think this has been really many years overdue. So I think it's a good step for Williams to be doing that. I think it's a good sign for the future. I don't think it's going to go to the extent of the pink Mercedes that we've seen at Racing Point and take as many parts as possible. I think it's going to be, it's just very sensible. And Williams, they said in their announcement that ultimately gives them the chance to divert resources and funding into other areas of the car. And it's just a couple of things less to worry about, which makes sense. So yeah, I thought that was really welcome news, and I think everyone's kind of looked at it and gone, yeah, this is overdue and just makes complete sense.
Well, John, I know you explained this in your column on autosport.com plus and motorsport.com prime, but it's a pretty significant moment in sort of Williams's history, especially, you know, it's quite a major departure from what they were doing before, and it's quite quick into the tenure of the new owners. So why is it so significant what the decision has been made as it is?
I think because it is it's one step beyond what the team have done in the past. There have been times where they've evaluated. I think the most recent time was 2018 into 2019. They were looking at, should we take a Mercedes gearbox, hydraulics, potentially rear suspension. And every time they've decided against it because of this kind of determination and pride factor of, we can do everything ourselves better. But I think Formula One's moved on, quite quickly now. We see collaborations up and down the grid. I think there's very few teams now aren't taking components from another outfit. And if you're a team wanting to push forward like Williams is, if you're in a midfield in Formula One at the moment where 1/10 can be the difference between Q3 and Q2 or Q2 and Q1, then, you know, producing parts yourself which are more expensive and which aren't as good. I think Williams remained the only team not to have a full carbon casing on their gearbox, for example, just leaving lap time on the table for no particular gain. So it's pointless having, you know, the best drivers in the world who are giving you that extra 1/10 a second if you're then leaving lap time there with car components that could be better simply by being bought elsewhere. So it is a philosophical change, but I think equally, I use some of your comments you did in an interview with Simon Roberts. This isn't about erasing the kind of the legacy of the Williams family. It's not about moving on to something totally different. It's just a pragmatic step, a sensible step to go forwards, bring performance, but still respect the Williams family and try and retain a lot of the positives that were there before.
Yeah, it's really interesting that interview, and Simon was sort of, I think the main point he was getting at was the sort of the feel inside the team, you know, is they still want to continue on the legacy and everything that the Williams family built in terms of how they all work together, make it a good place that people want to work at and do well and succeed and bring the team forwards at the same time. And as you say, John, this does seem like a very pragmatic and sensible step, and it has worked out very well for other squads. Luke, you suggested, I think correctly, that this won't be going as far as what Racing Point sort of were doing with Mercedes. Obviously, that's a completely different situation in terms of the copying, in inverted commas, when it comes to the pink Mercedes of last year, the W10, and then the RP20 for Racing Point's 2020 car. Obviously, that's now Aston Martin for 2021. Other teams are doing this. So where do you think this might sit closer? Is it more sort of similar to what Haas and Ferrari have in their relationship, or perhaps what AlphaTauri and Red Bull have, which is kind of like the original one, if we trace back the sort of modern history of two teams being quite closely linked?
Yeah, I would imagine, I think as John said, as it's sort of a first step, I would imagine it's maybe a step back from probably both of those. I think that Haas, I mean, they came in and quite blatantly said, look, this is our model that we want to take as much as we can. And I don't think Williams are going down that route at all. I think they've just looked at the one big area where they could do that, and it just makes complete logical sense, and have taken the decision to do that. So I don't think it's quite going to be to maybe the extent that Haas is. We know that AlphaTauri, they do still build quite a good chunk of the car themselves at Faenza, but do take a lot of the rear suspension and rear end of that car from Red Bull Technologies. So I think it's, it's maybe sitting a little bit closer towards that. So I don't think it's going to be so much of a sort of A team and B team relationship. I think it's going to be a bit of a different partnership. But I think it's going to be interesting, as John said, I think that so few teams now go without any kind of link to another team. So it does make complete sense. And I think it's going to be interesting for the future as well, maybe looking a bit more long-term. Mercedes, obviously they've had struggles in a couple of points with Esteban Ocon, most notably a couple of years back, and almost with George Russell when there were rumours that Sergio Perez could take a seat, that they've not really got enough space to put their juniors in F1. So if this relationship, if there is scope down the line for maybe when the next Mercedes junior driver is coming through, for Mercedes to place him at Williams, I think that would be really good for them as well. So yeah, I think it's a good tie-up for all parties. I think it just makes a lot of sense.
Another interesting feature I thought of that chat I had with Simon Roberts, it was at the, I think it was the Sakhir Grand Prix just before, for the end of the season, the second one in Bahrain last year, was that he sort of talked about there is a long-term plan that they're putting together with Doralton Capital, the sort of the new owners at Williams. So is this the sort of the first step of many more big decisions? Maybe not as significant as this, but just a sort of a whole change of the ethos and things that are going to be implemented as time goes on?
I think it's the first step, but I sense there's not... What I quite like about the kind of the Simon Roberts and Doralton approach is they've not come in all guns blazing and saying, right, we're going to do things differently and we're going to invest this money and we're going to be winning races in 2 years' time and it's, you know, onwards and upwards and we're going to be the most successful team. It's been quiet, you know, very calm. They've not been much fanfare. I haven't read any kind of big shouty headline news stories from them talking about wild ambitions. I think it's a case of steady progress. And, you know, Simon's talked about a long-term game plan of 5 to 10 years, but not targeted on specific results, not targeted on, you know, crazy ambitions of world championship, just making a success of it over 5 to 10 years. So, which I think, you know, is the right approach. And as we move to this new era from 2022, where budgets will be equal, where the cost cap will start making a difference, we'll start biting the top teams very hard, probably not straight away, but by 23-24, I think we'll see quite a big transition in the grid. And if the cars can race closer to each other, then, you know, why not a team like Williams, you know, on a good weekend, getting a podium, getting a win over the next 2 to 3 years?
Indeed. Well, we should move on to the final topic we're going to be discussing on today's show, which is sadly a negative one. And it's the news that came out at the very start of this week, almost sort of the first news story in Formula One in 2021, was a bit of a hangover, a depressing one. I mean, everybody, I'm sure, I know I did, had a bit of a hangover at the start of 2021. But it was the news that basically the expected season opener in Australia is set to be postponed, but it's a really crucial difference, not cancelled as it was outright last year. The plan is, we think, to reschedule it later into the 2021 schedule as a result of the continuing coronavirus pandemic, the restrictions in Australia, in Victoria, the problems that are coming out in the UK with the new variant of COVID-19 that's causing such problems in this country. And obviously that's where most of the teams and F1 itself is based. Can you just explain what the latest is regarding that situation, please?
So it is looking... it is going to happen that the Australian Grand Prix will be postponed. And as you say, it's with the restrictions in place in Australia, they've got to have a 2-week quarantine for any personnel, anyone coming into the country, whether you're an Australian resident or not. And that means that F1, if they realistically wanted to hold the race, everyone would have to get there about 3 weeks before, which obviously would just makes no logistical sense. And plus there's concerns of the new variant, and obviously with the paddock being so UK based, it's it would pose a big risk. So it's understandable why they're taking the decision. So it is, I think, a case of trying to see what new date they could find. And there's been suggestions that later in the season, how could they maybe fit everything around? And I think realistically, if they did want to get Australia in, the only thing they could do would be to bump Brazil to form a triple header with the USA and Mexico, and then that would free up a gap where Australia can maybe slot in as a standalone event, and that would create quite a hectic end to the season, dotting between South America, North America, Australia and the Middle East. But we shall see. And then I think obviously we're looking to what is the rescheduled start to the season. So that will be in Bahrain on March 28th. The team's currently talking about when to put testing, because obviously it makes more sense to have testing in Bahrain than it does in Barcelona as planned. The teams are fully agreed that the testing should be in Bahrain now, but they're undecided on what dates that should be on, whether it is putting it as close to the race as possible. The sporting regulations, they say that pre-season testing must finish no later than 10 days before the start of the season. So that would point sort of around March 16th has been the real cutoff point, but some teams want it earlier than that. So we've got to see. We've got testing for F2 in Bahrain. That's from the 9th to the 11th of March. So F1, I guess, would fall to one side of that. And then really we're looking sort of to the early part of the season, and already we've got question marks over the Chinese Grand Prix in Shanghai, which is scheduled for 2 weeks after Bahrain, whether that can go ahead. Obviously, big question marks over that. It's looking possible that we may end up with two European races as rounds two and three of the season following Bahrain, so that the TBC rounds that was in originally Vietnam slot, that's always been looking to be perhaps either Imola or the Algarve circuit in Portimao. It's going to be possible that we may have both of those in as rounds two and three of the season. So that's what we're looking at. And then really it's just a case of seeing how the pandemic moves in Europe. And there are just so many question marks over what kind of season we're going to get. And it's just so hard to look ahead and say in 2, 3, 4 months time what it's going to be like and how it's going to be. But I think, yeah, it's important they've taken this decision on Australia nice and early. We're just waiting formal confirmation of the postponement, which is anticipated in the coming weeks. And yeah, it just shows that F1, I think they're already looking quite far ahead, and it's not going to be a repeat of last year. And obviously we all got to Melbourne only to find out a couple of hours before FP1 that the weekend wouldn't be happening.
What is the speculation about the Chinese Grand Prix? Why is that under threat, or why is there a question mark there? Is it more that there is very, very little prevalence of COVID-19 there and they don't want to risk it being brought back, or is there a further issue that's at stake?
Yeah, I think that's really the main focus there, and it is that other sporting events in China are still very gently being reintroduced. So I think to come back with such an international event would be a bit of a big undertaking for them, really. And F1, obviously, they proved in Abu Dhabi that they can sort of make the biosphere plan work in terms of getting everyone in and just going in and out. But I think, yeah, it is China is maybe just wanting to be a little bit more wary about things, because they have, as you say, sort of got it under control, that to then open up the paddock to a very European and UK based sport, I think that would present a lot of risks. So yeah, I think that's why there's question marks there. But thankfully, F1, they sort of know from last year what tracks they can try and get in, how to run races at these tracks. So it could well be also that it sort of gets rid of the headache of, well, do we have Imola or Portimao in that Vietnam slot, and actually have both in the end.
There is talk of some of the races that appeared unexpectedly on the 2020 calendar being slotted in sort of the early season after Bahrain to mean that things do kick off sort of around the expected time, and perhaps potentially avoiding the long delays of the season that we ended up having during the first wave of the pandemic. But is that part of a sort of a specific contingency plan that F1 has got, or is it more a case that it's always been working on the fact that this was a fluid calendar, despite the fact it was set sort of, you know, at 23 races, but that was just done for sort of contractual reasons in terms of the races that were signed and sealed?
Yeah, I think when they announced the calendar, I mean, there were two options when they announced the calendar at the end of last year. You either announce a full calendar or you announce no calendar. Basically, it was a binary choice, really. You couldn't put tons of asterisks and endless complications. So it made more sense to announce a full calendar, even if you knew it wasn't really realistic to go ahead with it. So sure, there's going to be disruption, and sure, it's not easy for anybody at the moment. But I think the big difference now from kind of 9 months ago when we headed to Australia was, A, Formula One's in a much better shape in understanding what's required to put races on. It did a brilliant job last year in getting 17 races in. So I think, you know, as we went into our first lockdown, which feels like 200 years ago, but, you know, no one was sure we'd even get one race done last year. I was certainly very sceptical. So, but I think as we head into what's now lockdown 7 or 8 or whatever we're in, I think we're fairly confident that we will get a full calendar in this season. It may not be 23 races, but we should get 16, 17 in. I think that gives the teams confidence, it gives the fans some confidence, it gives the whole sport some confidence. So, you know, sure, there's some difficult days ahead. Sure, it's not going to be easy for anybody to kind of go through the challenge in the next few weeks, and for F1 to try to sort out this calendar as it goes along. But we are going to get a season this year. I think there's no doubt about that. And I think that's quite a big positive as we start the year.
Indeed. Well, I just want to end on a slightly flippant note for what is a very serious situation, in that I've got a plan that I think Formula One should implement, and I want to know whether you guys agree, and also whether you can spot all the problems with it. So first of all, I think go to Bahrain. They want to have the race back. That you're probably willing to pay for it, things like that. You know, the way that everyone was treated at the end of last year for the two races there, absolutely fantastic in terms of getting the event happening, and they've got the facilities and the resources, and they're very willing to do it. Have testing there, great, all makes sense. Why not have two races? Why not repeat the Sakhir Grand Prix? If they're all there and there's going to be a big gap, have another one. Makes sense. Now that brings me on to my next idea, which I think after Bahrain, the next round should be Silverstone, because you've got the majority of the teams based in the UK. There was already talk last year when, as John, as you said, there was speculation that it might not even get a season, and that was feared. Silverstone itself said, you know, we offered to host 12 races just to fulfill the TV contracts. I know a lot of people on Twitter got very angry about that. Don't quite know why. It's a very sensible, pragmatic suggestion. Obviously not completely, you know, it was never going to happen, but, you know, everyone was willing to try anything just to get a season in. This is my idea. As most of the teams are based in the UK, you bring over the Italian teams and Pirelli and the Swiss teams for Alfa Romeo, the Swiss guys based there for Alfa Romeo. Base them here for a little while, do three races. So do what we did for the British Grand Prix and the 70th anniversary Grand Prix, change the tyre compounds. Obviously, it's a different time of year. So it was, the heat was a big factor in why both of those races, the British Grand Prix was terrible, but ended up being very exciting. 70th anniversary Grand Prix was excellent throughout. But the heat was a big factor there, obviously different if it was to be like sort of late March, April time or whatever. But then I think you do a third race on one of the alternative Silverstone layouts, because that's been proved to work at the Sakhir Grand Prix. It was a very short track. It worked. Silverstone's got that. You got the national circuit, you got the different layouts. I think that works very well. Now, there are problems with this plan. I appreciate it. I appreciate, and I'm hoping you pick me up on several of them. Number one being Silverstone needs fans and Formula One needs money. But what do you think? Do you think that could work?
No, because the alternative layout thing can't work, because they haven't got a layout kind of approved by the FIA. Bahrain, bizarrely, is the only F1 track on the calendar with multiple configurations lined up. I like the idea of two in Bahrain. I liked the outer loop race. But I think there's no better place to kick off the European season than Imola, to be honest. You can't beat the magic of being at Imola in kind of April, kind of early, late April time. Magical place to be, great place to start the European season. And I think I'd much rather push Silverstone, you know, around July time. By then, hopefully, you know, we're seeing the tail end of the kind of the vaccinations and a bit of encouragement, get some fans in at Silverstone. And I think even if we can get, you know, 1,000 fans spread out across multiple grandstands at Silverstone, I think that'd be a much, much better solution for Silverstone and the British Grand Prix than trying to rush three races early on in April.
I do like the international. I've played it a bit on the F1 2020 video game. I think they've actually got it in there that you can try out on there, and it is quite good fun. But I think we just need to, again, we're looking so many months ahead, but I think that if we can get to a position in sort of July, August, that traditional British Grand Prix slot, to get fans back at Silverstone, that would be magic. That'd be absolutely amazing. So I think any possibility we can have of that, I think we've got to keep that as open as possible. I think that if the flyaway races are coming sort of into doubt, I think sort of thinking of Canada, Baku, those two races sort of that break up the bulk of the European season, I think that really we've got to wait until then if we were to, say, stick Silverstone in for two weekends again. But I think let's maybe wait a little bit into the summer. I also, when did they run a British Grand Prix in April? Was it 2000? And it absolutely pissed it down.
Yeah, 2000.
Oh, yeah, 2000. That went really well, didn't it? Yeah. Mm. that one I hadn't considered as a potential pitfall. You know, there's still a lot less muddy field, especially if you didn't kind of have spectators. Anyway, right, I'm just digging myself further into a hole. Fine, I shall not send off my PowerPoint presentation to Stefano Domenicali at Formula One or Stuart Brinkle at Silverstone. I shall keep that firmly under wraps. But anyway, nevertheless, it's always good to end on an upbeat note in what is remain challenging and terrible times. And we do hope everybody is keeping as well as they can do. So, we think we should end things there and just say thank you very much, Luke and John, for coming on the podcast today. And of course, thanks to everybody listening along. Just before we go, we'd like to remind you that the latest issue of Autosport magazine comes out on Thursday and will be available on the supermarket shelves and in newsagents, as well as on the doormats of subscribers. There'll be a new issue of the magazine for you to pick up every Thursday, packed full of news, analysis and the usual stunning photography. And of course, if you want unlimited access to Autosport from the comfort of your home, visit autosport.com/plus to find out how to subscribe to our digital package. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Autosport Podcast.
Music is 6am by Trilo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/Trilo Music.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.